Good afternoon and welcome to the EcoNews Report, a production of the North Coast Environmental Center, in conjunction with KHSU, located on the campus of Humboldt State University. I am Raina Nanayel, your host for the EcoNews Report. I'm Executive Director of the North Coast Environmental Center, and our guest today is Antonio Llanos. He is the Director of the North Coast Professional Chapter of Engineers Without Borders. He is also a project engineer with Michael Love & Associates. He will be speaking with us today about issues related to in-stream passage, diversions to fish passage, and also, and most especially, his project with sister cities in Nicaragua for Engineers Without Borders. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I think we're actually going to start off the show talking about your special project as director with North Coast Professional Chapter of Engineers Without Borders. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do just broadly with that program?
Yeah, I'm the director and was one of the founding members of the local chapter of Engineers Without Borders. It's a national organization, and there are chapters throughout the U.S. and throughout the world. And we decided that we need to have an Engineers Without Borders chapters here because there are a lot of engineers who are interested in international work, and we have a student body that's very interested in that. Most EWB chapters work in conjunction with a university chapter. So we have a HSU chapter, and now we have a professional chapter as well.
And I understand that all of this is kind of revolves around this notion of a sister city project, in a sense, which is also a national or international program. Is that right?
What we did is, after we started the EWB chapter, we were looking around for projects to do. And there's a variety of places we can do projects. But I have known about the sister city project with Arcata and Kamwapa, Nicaragua, for some time. And so we approached them and just introduced ourselves and said that we are a group of engineers and we have technical experience. And if they need anything like that, we'd be happy to help. And that just started our relationship with them and has been going on for a couple of years now.
So how does a sister city project work exactly?
Well, the sister city project there's a commission in Arcata and there's a commission in Kamwapa, Nicaragua, and they interact. But the main idea behind the sister city project is to facilitate a cultural exchange between their community and our community. Their town is about the same size as Arcata. They're anywhere from 15 to 20,000 people, depending on who you ask. And they're a fairly rural agricultural area. They have done quite a few cultural exchanges. Groups of high school students have gone to Kamwapa, and groups of students from Kamwapa have come to Arcata. They fund a lot of educational grants for the town of Kamwapa. And now with this partnership with EWB, we're working with them to improve their water system and look at water-related projects for the town.
Is this the first time that Engineers Without Borders has become involved with a sister city project?
It's the first time with the Arcata Kamwapa sister city project. Part of the mandate for EWB is to have an NGO partnership, a non-governmental organization that we partner with either in country or in the U.S. And so that worked out really nicely. And the other big advantage, of course, is that they have a 28-year relationship with the town of Kamwapa. And so that allowed us to immediately be introduced to all the right people, the directors of the program there, leaders in their community. It gave us an opportunity to be instantly connected into that community. And that would have taken months, even years, to establish if we'd just gone down there on our own, which is usually how EWB projects start.
What kind of work does Engineers Without Borders typically get involved with?
Typically, it's water-related or energy-related programs. The idea behind Engineers Without Borders is to improve sustainable engineering practices in other countries, to improve the way of life of local communities, generally, of course, developing countries. But we do local projects as well. And one of the main mandates of EWB is to work and train students who are becoming engineers, to train them in sustainable engineering and environmental practices, that sort of thing. So that is one of the main goals of EWB as well.
So I know that you're working and focusing on water issues there in large part. What can you tell me about what you've seen in the country of Nicaragua with regard to water problems? And why is water such a difficult resource to work with?
I would first off say Nicaragua is fantastic, and it's a beautiful country and incredibly friendly and easy to travel through. So we really enjoy going there, like I said, for the cultural reasons. And one of the interesting things about Kamwapa being that it is a fairly large city, it's a big town, they have a pretty developed water system. They have a reservoir, dam, and a water treatment plant and a distribution system in town. But there is a lot of small systems where they get water from shallow groundwater wells, and they do some rainwater catchment. And they get a lot of rain in the rainy season. So the problem isn't always a lack of water, although in the dry season it can be difficult. And a lot of it is just transporting the water, getting it to where it's needed. and the resources to do that can be expensive. So that's a big part of it. Why it's hard to work with, probably because everybody needs it. Everybody needs water.
Right.
And there's environmental needs for water too. And so balancing human needs and environmental needs is always difficult. Although there, it's more just water for agriculture and water for human use.
So I know that in our own country, we have tried to contain water. And one of the things that's very difficult about water is that it moves a little more than other infrastructure, potentially. It slams into it, it resists, it moves. But down there, with regard to the infrastructure, what is the difference of how the infrastructure is kind of growing as opposed to in the U.S., for example?
Maybe one of the main differences is it's a little more designed here. It's a little more thought out. I think things kind of happen on an as-need and as-affordable basis in places like that. They expand the system when they can. They dig wells where they can afford it. And there isn't as much foresight into overall use in terms of demands and environmental impacts. I think that's probably one main difference.
Mm-hmm. And then with regard to other environmental issues, what other environmental challenges in the engineering field do you see as being really important projects for Kamwapa?
There's quite a few things going on there that were piquing our interest. There's a big campaign right now to change how they develop the land. They do a lot of burning in their eyes to reintroduce nutrients into the soil, but that creates a lot of erosion problems, and there's a lot of heavy rain there, and so it's no surprise that there's landslides and bridge washouts when hurricanes come through, that sort of thing. So there is a kind of a movement to change the way they manage the land. In the case of Kamwapa, their main water supply comes from a reservoir with a dam, and so there's a lot of sedimentation happening in that dam. That's becoming a big issue for them as far as their quantity of water. There's pollution issues, of course, and that's something that is a big challenge. But I've talked with other people, and we kind of see, especially in Kamwapa, that the issue of watershed restoration is definitely a potential, but it's all about education and changing priorities.
So what kinds of strategies might you employ to kind of hold the soil in places like that? And I'll remind people listening that there's a really strong connection between erosion and water systems or water quality, because, you know, when all that soil is sliding down into the watersheds or water systems, that, you know, then you're having backed up soil, you're having systems that don't flow and that kind of thing.
They are promoting the idea of not burning and allowing more revegetative growth, changing forestry practices, just like here is a big issue, and how they manage with cattle and whatnot. It's a very volcanic soil there, and it's pretty erosive. So it's naturally erosive and high turbidity in the streams, but it's also really dense vegetation, and so that sort of holds a lot of it together.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not an area where we've explored too much yet. It's kind of something we're putting on the plate for later. It's definitely an issue that I think would be good to explore.
And being an engineer yourself and having worked with in-stream restoration and dams and road crossings and culverts and you name it, what kinds of parallels have you seen there? What kinds of lessons have you learned? In what way did you become enriched yourself through this Sister City project in seeing relationships between the two issues in different countries, even in spite of the economic disparities?
And I think part of it is the realization that in places where it's a sustenance style of living and people are hoping to have water on a day-by-day basis, environmental concerns aren't as much of a priority. And so that's one thing we have sort of the luxury to consider, is the environmental impacts of our development and our action. My background is in fisheries related type of work, and so I'm still getting a handle on what the fisheries situation is there. But I think one big lesson that we can learn and impart, and it's a hard one to impart, is that we've made these mistakes here in terms of creating fish barriers and just degrading habitat. And in a lot of places, they haven't made those mistakes yet. And so it's part of how can we encourage them to move in a different direction than we already have gone. And that's always a tough sell, but it's an educational process as well.
I was thinking when you were talking about that, what things we might be able to learn ourselves from Kamwapa, Nicaragua, or from the people there with regard to just the importance of culture. What kinds of things did you run into there that you might think that they could really teach us or have taught us in coming over and instructing through Engineers Without Borders if they were coming over here?
Yeah, and they do come once in a while, and we're trying to figure out more ways to do that. In the past, we've had midwives and potters and artists and dancers come here and sort of facilitate that cultural exchange for us and teach us about their culture, which is fantastic. There are some people doing some interesting sustainable agriculture down there that I think we could learn from. I did meet some people when we were on the coast of Nicaragua who are doing sea turtle rescue operations, and sea turtles are a big part of the ecosystem on the coast of Nicaragua. There's a lot of estuaries, and they're very endangered, and they're kind of like our salmon. They're just kind of struggling to hang on, and there are some people that are working really hard to preserve and protect the sea turtles that are there. They have these hatcheries programs. They have patrols that walk the beach at night to make sure nobody's poaching the eggs. And that's a tough situation because it's an economic resource for the local fishermen, but they're trying to protect them. And so they have a group that are always looking for volunteers and supplies and people to go down and help out with these projects. They're at seaturtlerescue.org, and they're on the north coast of Nicaragua. So that's another great organization to check out. I think the thing personally that strikes me the most is just how simple their lives are. You know, we live in this world of possessions and big houses and stuff, and they just don't have a lot of that. I mean, they have what they need, and everybody's very happy and well-fed, but they just don't have a lot of stuff. And there's kind of a simplicity in their lifestyle that I really admire.
Just personally, just for a minute, I know you've given us a lot of that. How did working in Nicaragua change your life, and what insights has this given into the problems of your own culture?
I think personally, though, just the experience is incredibly enriching. And anytime you meet people of a different culture and they take you into their home and show you their life and share that with you, you just can't help but be enriched by that. And I think that's something that we can all benefit from. And part of the fun I have on these types of projects is when we go and bring a group of students, you know, we all stay in houses with families, do homestays, and that's, again, facilitated by the Sister City group. It's just a whole new experience. And for people who haven't traveled a lot, it's a real eye-opener as to how the rest of the world lives and how people can live simply and be really happy. And you adjust really quickly to things like not having showers or flush toilets or new microbes. So I think there's something about that experience that sort of enriches anybody who travels.
And are there opportunities for people to volunteer either with the Sister City Project or for Engineers Without Borders?
Yeah, either. The Sister City Project is, like I said, it's been happening for 28 years, and they meet monthly at the Arcata Library. I think it's the second Wednesday of the month at 7. So they're always looking for volunteers to be involved. And the big thing is the iBlock party, which is coming up on September 5th. That's a great way to get involved and find out more. And Engineers Without Borders also is always looking for people to be involved. And they don't have to be engineers. We need people to help us write grants. We need people who are involved in the health side of things, because that's a big part of what we do. Is a lot of clean water is really is a health issue. And we are always looking for people to help with all kinds of projects. So they don't have to be engineers.
And you said that there was an event coming up, the iBlock Party, and
yeah,
that is the 5th of September?
Yes, the iBlock Party is an annual event. It's the main fundraiser for the Arcata Kamwapa Sister City Project. It's called the iBlock Party because it's a block party on I Street in Arcata, just across the street from Los Bagels.
That sounds fun.
And it's great. It's free. Most of the fundraising happens in selling food, and there's barbecue and selling beer. There's lots of crafts that we've brought back and some paintings that we'll sell. There is a raffle, all kinds of stuff. EWB will have a demonstration ram pump and rope pump set up, which is how they get water out of a well in Kamwapa. So the students made one to use as a demonstration. So that event itself kind of funds the grants and programs that Sister City sends money to Kamwapa with. There's music. There are three bands this year. There's the Striped Pig Duo, Gordissimo, with Rose Armand Hoyland, and Vintage Soul. So come down and check out some music and have a few beers and eat some barbecue.
It sounds like a lot of fun. I'll be there. So we're going to switch gears a little bit here. And I recently met you at an event put on by the Trees Foundation, the Salmonid Restoration Federation, Department of Fish and Game, and the Smith River Alliance, called the Coho Confab. We had a great time out there on the Smith River at the Rock Creek Ranch, which is a gorgeous place, learning about in-stream habitat and obstructions to fish passage and, gosh, fish identification and you name it, essentially centered around salmon conservation. And you have a fisheries background. You work as an engineer doing a lot of in-stream habitat improvement, working with roads and crossings, bridges, trying to repair barriers to fish passage, among other things. Can you talk to us a little bit about what you do in your day job?
Sure, happily. Yeah, that was a great event. I think SRF is a great organization, and they fund a lot of these. And I know that was an action-packed weekend for all that were there. It was a lot to do. So in my other hat is as an engineer with Michael Love and Associates, and our main focus is Fish Passage, but we do also work in estuary restoration, hydraulics around Fish Passage, hydrology studies, that sort of thing. And we also do some educational outreach, like giving those workshops on Fish Passage, and we've developed a software called Fish Crossing that is used by scientists and engineers and biologists to assess barriers to Fish Passage. So that's sort of our day job. That's kind of our, it's a small consulting firm. There's three of us that work there.
So I guess we should start out, for those who don't know, I mean, there's almost nothing so tragic as knowing that you could restore a stream. You could spend millions of dollars making it perfect, gorgeous riparian area, great, and then have one culvert at one road crossing that keeps the fish from being able to migrate and spawn for the entire rest of the river. And having seen that on numerous occasions myself, I don't think people understand exactly how prevalent this is, how many barriers to fish passage there are besides the large-scale dams. Would you mind talking a little bit about
that? Yeah. For the most part, I think the listeners, your listeners and the people on the North Coast are pretty salmon savvy. I think we all kind of understand the life cycle of salmon. But for those that don't, they migrate upstream to spawn and lay their eggs in gravel. And so they're always looking for good upstream habitat. Usually they go pretty far upstream. Some salmon, the coho, are more low-gradient spawners. And then steelhead are kind of the ones that go further upstream. So anytime there's an impediment to that, to them accessing that habitat, it becomes a problem. So you could have miles of habitat that's perfect for spawning, but if they're blocked by, like you said, by one culvert, then that habitat is off limits to them. So in a culvert, for people who don't know, it's a pipe. It's a tube that crosses under a road. Anytime a road crosses a stream, there's some sort of a crossing. Ideally, it's a bridge. Worst case scenario is it's a culvert. And worst case scenario is a culvert that's too small. The way we kind of think about culverts is it's sort of an earthen dam across the channel with a little straw through the bottom of it. And if it's too small, it'll create conditions where the water's too fast and fish can't swim against it. That high energy water coming out of a culvert will scour a pool downstream of it, and that'll create a drop or a perch. Fish can't leap into the culvert and swim upstream. So a lot of what we encounter as barriers are drops, are big perches, where a small waterfall where the fish can't get past because they just can't leap that high and swim through a high velocity culvert. So a lot of what we do is find ways to replace that or improve that kind of situation. So it's not just dams. It's anytime a road crosses a stream, there's a potential for a blockage or a barrier.
And this is interesting, too, because they weren't necessarily constructed that way. These are events that happen over the course of time due to maybe a lack of foresight of understanding how to make something that will last or make something that won't result in that kind of scour. So your job as an engineer with Michael Love and Associates, I would presume, is to construct projects that will last the test of time and hopefully mimic to some extent or at least be able to handle natural ecological events.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And, you know, there are lots and lots of culverts that are barriers, and there's lots that aren't, but there are lots. And I don't fault the engineers who design them, because that's how we've always been taught, is to design something for hydraulic efficiency. A smaller culvert costs less money, and it efficiently conveys water through it. And that was the goal for most of our engineering development. But now we're realizing that there are consequences to that. And one of them is that we lose an ecological connectivity between upstream and downstream. And one of the big ones is wood and debris and sediment. Rocks that normally move downstream along with the flow now are being held up. And a lot of times they'll end up causing more problems by plugging a culvert and then destroying that culvert, and the road crossing goes with it. So what we look at is how to size a culvert to accommodate not only fish passage, but also to accommodate the ecological connectivity that's needed between up and downstream. So we can have not only fish moving up and downstream, but also amphibians and wildlife, wood and rocks and everything else that needs to move downstream and upstream. So we try to design crossings to accommodate for that. And then the upside is it's a lot less maintenance. They are more expensive, but then in the long term, they don't have to be replaced as often, and they reduce the amount of maintenance costs that are associated with them.
So when we talk about more expensive, just to have a general notion, let's just take your average-sized, you know, Army Corps of Engineer, no offense. No, I'm kidding. They're changing too. Culvert, and compare that to something you might do on a instead of a culvert or a narrow culvert. What kind of difference in cost are we really talking about?
Well, there's a lot of variability. If you're on a logging road, you know, the main cost is the metal, the pipe itself. But if you're on a public road, there's lots of permitting issues that are associated with that. But generally speaking, you know, a culvert itself can be $60,000, $30,000, depending. But an overall project to install it, put it in, put the road fill, put the road back on top of it, $60,000 or $80,000. To provide a larger culvert for fish passage that resists scour and improves transport of all the watershed products, as we call them, those are looking at usually $200,000 to $300,000. So they're considerably more, but again, in the long term, not so much.
Yeah, because economically, it's kind of more feasible in the sense that you don't have things clogging it up. You don't have those drops and scours. You don't have roads being washed away because of a huge storm event. So I have it just broadly that on many rivers in the Northwest in general, dams contribute to losses of up to 85 to 90% of anadromous salmon, and variably. But we're seeing a great loss of anadromous salmon due to diversions and also due to barriers to fish passage in specific dams. What are our options there? Because that's a really intense kind of infrastructure. And of course, we're seeing the same thing on the East Coast, where they've pretty much got 90% barriers going on to much of the upper watershed in New England. So what are we supposed to do in light of the scale of these infrastructures? Because it kind of becomes cost prohibitive at a certain point. So then we get into the things like fish ladders and fish pumps, which cause a lot of mortality to salmon. You're the engineer. You're the engineer. You tell us what to do.
Well, when it comes to dams, I say take them down. We don't need those anymore. A lot of dams, they all have a lifetime. They're short-lived. They fill with sediment. Whatever purpose they were built for, often it's not useful anymore after years and years. 20, 30 years is a common lifespan for a dam. So the cost of putting that in, I don't think is often not worth it. But it's important to think, to consider this too, when we look at dams and dam removal, which is sort of the new thing in stream restoration and a lot of the projects we're doing, is I think people have this vision of Hoover Dam and Matilaha Dam and these gigantic structures, which granted are a marvel of engineering, but most dams that cause fish passage problems are small. They're 2-3 feet high. And we see a lot of those in the Sierras. We see a lot of them, like you said, on the East Coast, and they're manageable. We can take those out. It's just a matter of prioritizing that. And a lot of them they're not in use for whatever diversion purpose they were originally put in for. So that's my solution for those, is let's take as many of those out as we can.
I've seen a lot of that in Napa and Sonoma. There are just more of them than you can imagine.
Yeah. And it doesn't take much to create a fish barrier. I mean, fish are pretty resilient, and steelhead especially can leap 6 feet even, but a lot of fish can't leap. And so it impedes passage to other species as well. And that's why replacing culverts is such a nice measure for improving fish passage, because it's very quantitative. We can count how many ones are barriers and how many we've replaced and how many stream miles we've opened up to passage and to new habitat. So I think that's sort of the way to go with dams, at least, is take them out with culverts that are too small. When it's time to replace them with something that's more appropriate, with a larger culvert is usually the case.
When I was at your presentation, you talked about different types or categories of restoration or projects available to us. Could you talk a little bit about those different categories?
Yeah, I'd love to. Basically, it's sort of two approaches, and which are supported by Fish and Game right now. And Fish and Game provides a salmonid habitat restoration manual that sort of has guided the practice for years. And we've recently updated that for design of fish passage projects. We've sort of broken it down into two main categories. One is what we call a hydraulic approach, and the other is a geomorphic approach. In a hydraulic approach, we're designing for a hydraulic condition that's suitable for the fish we're interested in. So in our case, it's usually salmon, steelhead, chinook, coho. And we know the types of conditions they can swim in. We know how high they can leap, how fast they can swim, generally speaking. So we design a structure that can make that condition during their migration window. The problem with that is that you're only allowing passage for one species. So a common example is a fish ladder. Fish ladders are often used at dams as a last resort, or they should be a last resort, to provide passage. And they only really accommodate one species of fish. If a fish doesn't leap, it's never going to get up that fish ladder. So that's the hydraulic approach, where we're designing for specific conditions in the water. The other approach is called the geomorphic approach. And when you have the resources and the space available, that's our preferred method. And what we do in the geomorphic approach is we take our cues from the stream up and downstream and the natural channel. And we try to simulate the natural channel under the crossing and simulate the conditions that we would normally find. So it's more of a restoration approach as opposed to just providing passage for one species. We've now opened up the stream for all the watershed products we talked about, wood and rocks that need to go through, and amphibians can go upstream. And basically we're trying to create a condition that's no more or less difficult than the native channel up and downstream of the culvert. So it's more of a ecological approach as the geomorphic approach.
And then just to remind people, it is really important for those large pieces of wood or just pieces of wood in general or debris to be moving through the channel, because they help to create the channel habitat.
It's very important. Yeah.
So, and I might also say, having seen some of these projects firsthand, they're also much more aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah.
They're actually quite beautiful.
Yeah, and there's appropriate situations for either approach. And there's sometimes we have to use a more engineered approach, a hydraulic approach. And there are times when that's what's available. But when we can do a more naturalized system, it's much more aesthetic. Essentially, what we're trying to do is make the crossing invisible to the fish, so they never realize they're going through a crossing.
And it does really work, and they are really very nice. I guess I wanted to just wrap up by saying that, or revisiting this notion of prioritization. So based on what you said before, if you yourself, as you know, engineer Tony, would set a prioritization, you would probably start with the smaller barriers because they're the most doable, but also maybe look at which streams and which rivers are priority rivers for salmon and migration.
Correct. Yeah. There's a few different ways to look at which barrier is the most important to remove. And right now the thinking is sort of going toward this idea of stronghold watersheds. So areas that have good populations, that have good habitat, the priority seems to be right now to protect those places, not degrade those. And then the other is to look at, you know, where in the system is this barrier? If there's a lot of barriers that are right at the mouth or at the most downstream end of the creek. So a lot of crossings that go under Highway 1, for instance, and places like that, that's right at the beginning of the migratory route up the stream. If that's a barrier, then everything upstream is off limits. So fixing those bottlenecks is a high priority. And sometimes the smaller ones aren't as much of a priority because fish are pretty resilient, and a lot of times they can get through those part of the time. They're what we call partial barriers. So part of it is figuring out, when are you going to expose the most habitat by replacing a certain crossing or removing a certain barrier?
And are you having pretty good luck working with Caltrans, Department of Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife Service on these types of projects? Are some of the old engineering-minded folks coming around?
Yeah. Well, we have great working relationship with all three of those organizations. Fish and Game and Fish and Wildlife Service fund a lot of the restoration projects that are done throughout the state. Fish and Game funds most of them. They have a fisheries restoration grant program. And Caltrans, being one of the main owners of a lot of these barriers, is working really hard to replace a lot of them. They have particular challenges because they're usually really large crossings on large highways that require a pretty expensive solution. But they are working. They have actually a fish passage department now, and their hydraulics engineers are on board with a lot of these projects. You know, they're a big bureaucracy, and they take a while to adjust to a lot of these changes. But no, they're very helpful. We have been doing a lot of work with Caltrans and assessing their barriers, finding out which ones are problems, and they're fixing a lot of them in-house.
I'm really glad to hear that, because there's just nothing so tragic as seeing those salmon struggle in places where they don't need to.
No, and they're amazing fish. Every time I work with them and see them, I'm just awed by their whole journey.
Mm-hmm. They have enough obstacles facing them,
yeah,
so to speak.
Exactly.
So thank you so much for being here, Antonio Llanos. I want to remind everybody about the iBlock party on the 5th of September. And that is a block party on I Street near Los Bagels. And what time does that start?
Starts at noon, goes till 6,
Excellent.
So all afternoon. Hopefully it'll be a sunny day, but even if not, come on down.
All right. And thank you so much for your work with Engineers Without Borders and for being here as our coho and salmonid fish passage fixer. So thank
you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. This has been the Econews Report, and my name is Raina Nanayal, and I've been your host for the past half hour. I was speaking with Antonio Llanos, director of the North Coast Professional Chapter of Engineers Without Borders and an engineer for Michael Love & Associates, talking about barriers to fish passage and many of the projects of Engineers Without Borders. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again at the KHSU website under archived programs at khsu.org. The Econews Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Much thanks to our engineer, Fred McLaughlin. Please join us again next Thursday at 1:30 p.m. here on KHSU for the Econews Report.